This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're joined by Richard Antoine White, principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic and Santa Fe Symphony, professor at the University of New Mexico, and a graduate of the Peabody Institute and Indiana University. We're discussing his new memoir, I'm Possible, A Story of Survival, a Tuba, and the Small Miracle of a Big Dream. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I found your memoir just riveting, and I'm curious to know why you felt it was important to share this story.
You know, I think my purpose now in life is just to inspire hope. And, you know, as the title, Impossible, Unpossible, Against All Odds, I think, especially now more than ever in our world and country's hurting, it's important to give people hope. It's important, whether they're at an advantage or disadvantage, to just show everyone that they can do it. And that's the purpose of my book, is simply to inspire hope across the country and further.
I noticed in the opening of the book, you'd mentioned just about, it kind of opens up on a scene of you getting ready to play and then talking about how you came from all these hardships and now it's possible for you and how it's possible for anyone. What made you feel like what you went through is something that anybody can overcome?
I was blessed with an extraordinary imagination. And I think a lot of people have dreams and imagination and they just don't feed it. I think you know, there's this old tale that says, you know, if you have a good person and a bad person, which person will grow the most? The person you feed the most. You know, I'm lucky that I was able to feed that good person that had some self-determination and that had an imagination and a dream that I was determined not to give up on. You know, and I also say in the book that sometimes in life you have to learn to be your own hero. I often credit everyone who helped me, every teacher, every mentor, every friend, definitely helped me along the way. But I did my part by working as hard as I could.
Well, you do write about your childhood in the first part of the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what life was like for you and your mother in Baltimore and how it relates to the bigger story?
You know, we woke up every day. We had two missions. Her mission was to serve her illness. My mission was to be a kid, you know, play, find enough corns in the gutter to get, you know, a chicken gizzard or chicken wing. Oftentimes, I'm pretty sure I didn't have enough money when I, you know, looked up like it was like the Eiffel Tower or something. That's how tall the chicken stand looked when you were 4 years old to get whatever I was trying to purchase. But every day was simply about living, surviving, and finding my mom. So I would play, find enough food or somehow eat. And then at the end of the day, I would look for her. And sometimes I was successful in finding her and sometimes I wasn't.
When it comes to the relationship that you had with your mom, you mentioned also in the book that some people said your mother wasn't capable of taking care of you. How did that affect you?
I think my mom is a hero. I think she did the most difficult thing that any parent can do, and that's to give her kid up so that I could have a better life. I think she played, she was dealt a hand and she played it to the best of her ability. And she would give me the shirt off of her back. I think, you know, our society is used to labeling and stereotyping because of the illness of alcoholism. Sure, she had a disease, but she loved me like any mom would love their kid and cared for me like any mom would care for their kid as best she could. And I'm grateful for that. And oftentimes I'm asked, would I change anything? The answer is absolutely not.
And that's an amazing way to look at things. As you said, there's so many stereotypes about illnesses and we often overlook the humanistic side of the person that's suffering.
Yes, and I think I've always preached, and I hope this message catches on like wildfire. There are thousands of problems in our country and world, and we're really hurting right now. I honestly believe that 99% of them can be solved if we were just kind to one another.
Yes, kindness can go a long way. I'm with you on that. And for our listeners who are tuning in, if you have any questions or comments for the program, for our guest, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. So tell us a little bit about this bond that you and your mother shared. It seems like it carried throughout.
Yeah, I think like animals, humans, there's a connection between mother and child. And I think we shared that connection where it was just me and her. And, you know, all things are possible. Just like any parent will go the distance, any parents will go beyond the distance to protect and to make sure their child is taken care of. In terms of resources, we all have differences in terms of how far we can take that child. I totally enjoyed my time with my mom. I enjoyed the stories she told me. I enjoyed the togetherness of her. And I'm always fascinated by that word, you know, because if you break it down, it says to get her. And ultimately, I have decided in 48 years of age now that it means to get her. And I think it really means to get Lady Liberty, to really have the three C's in life: a chance, choice, and change. We all just want a chance to make the right choices to see the kind of change that we desire for betterment.
Now, on your journey, as we look back to the memoir here, there was a chapter about the blizzard and how major changes started to happen for you. Can you tell us about what that was like from I guess, your early childhood to this incident?
You mean after the blizzard or during the blizzard?
After the blizzard.
Oh, I had difficulties. I moved in with this foster parents whom, first of all, I think I actually call their house Buckingham Palace, which it was amazing because you ate three meals a day. I would have just giant, to me, seemed like the biggest sandwich ever. So I would stick half of it in my pocket and eat half of it. And they were like, this is all yours. If you want another one, just ask for it. And I'm looking at them like, yeah, right. I'm going to keep this sandwich in my pocket. I was so angry at them at that age for taking me away from my mom that I talked to myself in the mirror for years. I was my best friend. I literally talked to myself. Sure, I had concepts of, you know, bathing and all that, but, you know, having a bath and then putting on these things called pajamas, that was not in my resume. So I would take a bath, they would wash me up, put me into bed, and I would find my dirty clothes and end up on the floor because that's what I was most comfortable with. So I had a lot of adjusting to do.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that's a huge adjustment to go from living one lifestyle to another. And what was it like? Was it more freedom when you were out with your mother versus having sort of rules and structure?
Yeah, you know, sometimes we had, you know, what I classify my homelessness as intermittent, you know. Aunt or someone would have us stay, and I would sleep in the bed with like six other people. If someone wet the bed, that was just your problem, things like that. And so we didn't have a regimented place. You didn't take a bath every day. You didn't brush your teeth every day. It was where you ended up, you dealt with the environment and the circumstances that were in front of you. So certainly the rules and the culture when I'm the transition was something that I had never experienced before.
I would think that also those types of experiences build a lot of resilience and ability to adapt.
Oh, it definitely gave me attitude to determine. I think in the movie, the film Ratuba, we met an old neighbor on the streets, and she said, yeah, last time I saw him, he was barefoot. He was waiting for his mom in the rain, and I asked him if he wanted a sandwich, and he said no. I wanted the sandwich, but I was just so tired of asking people for stuff that I just didn't. I was done with it. I was going to find my own way.
And what was it like, you know, when with this new structure, now you're sort of in a new chapter. Did anything sort of open up for you or change your perspective?
Oh, yeah. Like I can answer this a lot of ways. You mean living wise or just the trajectory of my whole life? Because that's how I would approach this question.
Yeah, I would say probably the trajectory.
In fourth grade, a music person came to school with a whole bunch of music instruments, and we got to choose what we wanted to play. And I said, I want to play trumpet. It's got to be easy. It only has three vowels. Boy, was I wrong. Trumpet is hard to play. I started playing trumpet, and I was failing. I wasn't performing well in school. And my parents had the genius idea to take the trumpet and to tell me that, give me an ultimatum, turn your grades around or you will never see this trumpet again. I was so determined to get that trumpet back because what music gave to me is a sense of belonging, is a sense of something that I create with like-minded people. So I've never failed a class since, a grade since, I should say.
So the trumpet was that the gateway for you to music, or did you have an interest before that?
Mom would sing to me on the streets, but I think it was the gateway to a lot of things. I think it was the gateway to community. I think it was the gateway to a sense of unity. I think it was the gateway to communication. And I think it was also, because of my failure, the gateway to determination.
So you, it sounds like you were never intimidated by these instruments. And I say this because I think, you know, when I see instruments, I feel intimidated. It's like a lot of work. You have to figure out how to play them and make it sound good. How did you approach it?
There are a lot of different ways to look at it. I think I definitely strip things down to their basic element, but I do take the long way to do things. Like I can make something very simple, very difficult. But once I get it, I got it. I'm always reminded of a quote that Bill Gates used. And he says, "I will always choose a lazy person to do a difficult job because he or she will find the easiest way to do it." So I'm not saying that I'm a lazy person and I find the easiest way to do things right away, but I take the long way, try it every which way possible, and then end up with the best way for me to do it.
Before we take a quick break, what was it like putting this memoir together? And we can probably pick up on this after the break as well. And just having to delve back into sort of emotional topics.
It's surreal. First of all, I had to contact a family that I don't remember or didn't know. I had to verify the things I was writing down, and I had to actually get credibility to what I was saying. Like, how do I know certain things and don't remember certain things? I had to contact a lot of people. And that was interesting because I was being introduced to feelings I think I suppressed. So mm-hmm. A lot of it was very emotional. And it's social media has made things weird. It's weird seeing family members that say they're your family. You're like, I've never seen you in my life. And I don't know who you are. Hi.
Yeah.
You know, social media definitely made it easier for me to contact people and to track down the facts of the story. But at the same time, I had to deal with the baggage.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break to play us out. We have Richard beatboxing on his tuba in a collaborative track with his brother, William. We're talking about a new memoir from tuba player Richard Antoine White. I'm Miriam Soh. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In.
Y'all can't see him now, because he's a pedigree. You got to say Dr. White, and that's the pedigree. I got it in, so I'ma just move. And if you understand me, then you know I'm smooth. I'm a cool.
This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. Today we're talking to tuba player and IU graduate Richard Antoine White, whose new memoir is called I'm Possible, a story of survival, a tuba, and the small miracle of a big dream. Before the break, we touched upon what it was like to revisit things for your memoir, Richard. Aside from having to sort of chase people down, verify facts, did you ever feel reluctant to go back and revisit some stories, or have you always been open about your journey?
I've been fairly open, and I'm glad I get to share it with the world. I think, like my mom, it was the hand I was dealt, and I played it to the best of my ability. I wouldn't change a thing because every single failure, every single success, every problem that I have had turned me into the person that I am today. And I like me when I get to work on me and make a better me. And I think my circumstances help me become a better me. I hope that makes sense to the listeners.
Yeah, definitely it does. And when it comes to the trumpet, you mentioned that, you know, that was sort of the first thing that you started with, thinking that it would be easy, and then your parents kind of taking it away from you until you got your grades up. What compelled you to continue?
We continued playing music in sixth grade. I was trumpet number 18, I think, out of 32. And I was like, this is not working out, is it? I looked up and saw the sousaphone, the instrument you wear. I said, I want to play that because it was only one. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion now. You know, when I'm in band or if I'm in orchestra, there's not a set of notes specifically set aside for African-Americans or a set of notes set aside for Caucasians. We all choose from the same notes. And what kept me going was that sense of collaboration, that sense of coming together to create something special. So I switched to tuba and never looked back.
And what is it that you find fascinating about the tuba that you've dedicated your life to this particular instrument?
Oh man, I believe in Tubby the tuba. I just want to play. I just want to play the melody. You know, the tuba is big, it's bulky, it's clumsy. I'm 6'5", 300 pounds. It's stereotype. It's the butt of all jokes. You know, but yet it's powerful. Yet it can dominate the orchestra. I often tell people my job in the orchestra is to show everyone else how much they suck at rhythm and pitch. I can I can make this shit float, or I can bring it down. So the tuba is a beautiful instrument. It has a lot of power. And I think that's what attracts me to it, that I have a lot of life relationships to it, life characteristics that are identical to the tuba.
A lot of people will say there was something pivotal that led them to a certain instrument or to find out that they had a talent. Is there anything that led you down this path, or was it just by chance that you happened to pick up music and then find out that you were really good at it?
Ultimately, the way I would answer that question is that it's the village that kept me on path. It's the village that kept reoccurring in my life. The one thing that every institution and every teacher has in my life that worked out for me is that no one ever gave up on me. I would be foolish to sit here and tell you, I did it. You know, I pulled myself up by the boots and strap. First of all, not everyone has boots and a strap. Second of all, you can work as hard as you can in this country and still fail. I credit the village for keeping me going. I credit the village for assisting in my work. And that pivotal moment kept repeating itself throughout my life.
And I think your story highlights just the importance of community and folks coming together.
I definitely believe that. And I think a lot of times we fall short in because no one wants to reach the point of exhaustion. But exhaustion is where new beginnings happen. When you've given it all you have, now you get to think about something that you haven't done. You know, we have a systematic problem in our country where we're quick to give help, maybe level 5 help. And if you don't achieve or excel at level 5 help, then you're a failure. You're not working hard. But we all have different strengths and weaknesses. What if this person just needs level 6 help and then they would elevate? I think we have to be willing to meet students where they are. And then we also have to find something that we love about each student so that we can establish ultimate endurance and that we don't give up on them. And I'm lucky that I had those things.
That's a really good point. And I'm just trying to marinate on it a little bit here, just thinking about, you know, maybe we do have help and support, but maybe we kind of leave people hanging too. We expect them to take it and be amazing. But there's more to it.
I agree. I think excellence is void of color. It's void of gender. It's void of bias. It's on the level or not. And what we have to provide is resources. If you want to be a Formula One race car driver, I'm saying that because of Indiana or Indy 5, and I give you a nice Toyota Camry and you go to the Indy 500, good luck with that. You know, that car is not equipped, no matter how talented you are. So I think what we want to do is establish the resources to allow everyone to compete at the level of excellence. But under no circumstances do we want to lower the bar of excellence.
If you weren't a musician, do you think you would be doing something completely outside of music?
Oh, I know exactly what I'd be doing if I wasn't a musician. I'd be a football player.
And why is that?
I wanted to be a football player. Like, I'm 6'5", 300 pounds. I broke my hip, and that's how I gravitated to the school for the arts and the tuba. I wanted to be a football player. I was supposed to be a football player. Ultimately, now I'm justified in my older years. I think maybe I would have been hit or something and been paralyzed. So the universe said, let's leave this football thing alone. But I love football. If I weren't a tubist in a different life or earlier and I didn't break my hip playing football, I would have been a football player. I broke my hip, and so I was like, well, what else can I do? Well, I can play tuba. I showed up at the Baltimore School for the Arts with crutches, with a sousaphone, the instrument that you wear. Auditions were over. The director just happened to be there because he forgot a document or something. And he said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm here to audition. And he said, what? Auditions were yesterday. And I looked him in the eyes with serious determination and said, but I'm here now. He said the audacity or determination made him go, well, I have to hear this young man. And the rest is history. I auditioned for him and I got into the Baltimore School for the Arts. Statistically, I think they'll hear 600 kids and they'll accept 35 of them. If you're wondering about the odds.
That's pretty amazing to be able to get in with those kinds of odds. What was that audition experience like? Did you expect that they'd be like, okay, fine, we'll let you audition even though you're a day late?
Well, you're the first person to ask that question. I think it was awkward is the word I would use. Because I played some Mozart thing that I had, and I had learned to read music by rote. I learned on a cassette tape. If you don't know what that is, I think you can Google it.
Oh, I know. I'm not that young.
Okay. I put a tape in and it said, "Hello, this is B flat. Do pause the tape. When you have mastered B flat, continue." That's how I learned. So I really couldn't read music. So Mr. Ford put a piece of music in front of me and he pointed to a note and he said, "Do you know what this is?" And I illustrate. I said, "Yeah, that's this." I pushed down my first finger. He said, "Yeah, but do you know what this note called?" I said, "Yeah, I say it's this." No note name. Just push my finger down. He said, "Oh, but you don't know the note name of this." I was like, "Man, it's this." Then he said, "Okay, well, how about if I play this on the piano? Can you play that back?" And I was like, "Of course." So I played it back. He said, "I'll be back." He left the room, made a phone call, and came back in and said, "You must be the luckiest kid on the planet. We're going to accept you into the Baltimore School of the Arts."
That's amazing.
They accepted me. Yeah,
what was that feeling like? Like, I mean, did you expect that quick of a decision?
No, I was very green. I left there going, "Okay, I'll see you next year." Right. And I got to call my dad. He said, "So how was it?" I was like, "I got in. No problem." That's what's going through my mind. But I casually just said, "I got in." I didn't realize at the moment what was happening or how historical it would become. You know, I just went up there and played tuba and did what I do. And I'm glad that they accept students based on potential and not where you necessarily are. I think that's another thing we have to change about our system in terms of having the ability to meet students where they are. Everyone won't walk into the front door where you think they should be. And we have a responsibility to be good stewards of the education we're providing. And I think it's not fair to ask a student to check their personality or characteristics at the door. You should allow them to be themselves and develop from there.
Yeah, and I wonder, looking back, just if these types of things were implemented, where folks might be, not to put regret and be like, if only, you know, they had these systems and then you could be something amazing now, but just the idea of meeting students where they're at and giving them that chance to grow rather than like everyone has to be at the same level at the same time.
Yeah. And, you know, I often speak about this because I don't think every single time the right formula was there for me, but I've developed this ideology of, instead of because I have this, I can't do that, because they didn't give me this, I can't do that. I think in spite of everything that's wrong and everything that I didn't get, I'm still going to show you. And that's my attitude.
So when you went to the Baltimore School for Arts, did that change sort of the level of your thoughts towards music and to make it even more like of a professional career goal?
I was exposed to a lot of different things. It was a difficult transition, not just musically. It was a difficult transition in terms of being an articulate person in academia, you know, pronouncing words axe instead of ask, or there's nothing strong with that. And I was trying to say there's nothing wrong with that. And so in my mind, all these tools of opportunity and betterment that were being provided to me were perceived as people trying to make me white. Mm. I didn't see them as tools to be a better me. I just say, you're trying to turn me into something I'm not. You're trying to make me white. So that transition was extraordinary. Once they asked me to be on TV and I found out that you can get scholarship, which translated to the street mind that I had into money, it was no turning back. I said, you can get money playing the tuba. Like, really? Is somebody? And then when they said, told me you can get thousands, they didn't say hundreds. I said, wait a minute, time out. I can practice this thing right here, and somebody gonna give me thousands of dollars to go to school. I'm finna practice. And I got to school at 7 o'clock every morning because I was determined to get some money. I was gonna make some thousands. That trajectory changed. That changed my work ethic. That changed my attitude. Because at that point, I think I realized that there will always be people more talented than me. There were talented people in the school and smarter probably, but I decided that no one's gonna outwork me and I control that.
I'm taking in all you're saying. I feel like I'm having a masterclass, so this is great, of just determination and strength and pushing through when all the odds are pretty much stacked against you. You love the tuba. It's an instrument that you say could speak to anyone. Can you explain what that means?
It means that, for me, musical notes are void of the complications of the alphabets. Like, sometimes I think chatter is too much sometimes. And I think a song can speak to you. A song can speak to the soul. A rhythm can speak to the soul. You know, there are different elements of music. And I think motion is different from emotion. For example, when I entered school for the arts, I couldn't really count rhythms. But I didn't have the motion part of music down. But boy, did I have the emotional part down because of my life experience. And I think that's what I mean when I say the tuba can speak to anyone. Like, I can absorb your feelings and try to translate them into a song. We can all relate to a song. And the beautiful thing is, you can hear a song, I can hear a song, we can hear the same song, but yet it means something different to each one of us. That's magic. Oh, sorry, the puppies.
Oh, no, that's all right. They're excited. They're enjoying the topic. Are they tuba fans when you play your tuba?
Oh, yes. One of them will sleep and won't leave my side. And when I open the door from the studio, she's going to be right there on the floor.
Well, when it comes to also like the tuba and just music in general, is it ever too late to learn music?
I don't think it's too late to do anything. If anyone's out there feeling like, oh, I should have did this, I'm too old. The best part about every day is that you're not done yet. That's my motto. You can start now. And, you know, time is the one thing we can't manipulate. You know, we all start living and dying the instant we're born. I don't intend to really work past 62 years of age because I realize that no matter how successful I get, I can't buy more time. So I need that time to do what I want to do. And I have a huge fear of leaving this earth before I get to do everything I want to do. And maybe a realization that I won't get to do everything that I want to do. And that makes me sad. But I don't think it's ever too late.
What are some of those things that you want to do that you think you don't have time?
I think some of them will get accomplished. So my bucket list is I want to make a yoga CD. Because I think it's the one category I probably can win a Grammy in. I want to say, and, you know, I did an interview the other day that's led to some offers. I want to be the first musician to say I performed on all 7 continents, Australia, Africa, and Antarctica are left, and I'm getting invitations to Antarctica now, so it's going to happen. And my last bucket list thing, which is I'm working on the most right now, is I want to build a raw tuba ranch. It'll be my home. And it'll be a place of fellowship. It'll have a stage and a place where if you're having a bad day, come on a Raw Tuba Ranch, 24/7, ramen noodle, chili, and beer. If you can't drink beer, we'll have some Kool-Aid for you. And we'll have barracks where you can stay if you overindulge. But those are my 3 bucket list items currently.
So you have some ties to Indiana. You came here for your master's and doctorate in tuba performance. Why did you decide to come here?
I love Indiana. Hoosiers all the way. And I'll be there, I think, next week. I'm coming to Indiana. It's like I'm there all the time. My mentor, teacher, Daniel Brantoni, is like my dad. IU represents excellence. You know, at IU, you fail a class. They don't lower the bar of excellence. They tell you, oh, it's just unfortunate you failed the class, but we'll be here when you retake this class, okay? So I chose Indiana simply because it had the best track record of tuba players getting jobs. There is not a professor that has a better track record than Mr. Daniel Parentoni.
Is it hard to find a program for tuba? It was my understanding, I think, that Indiana and maybe somewhere else is the only place where you can get a PhD.
I think that's not exactly accurate. You can get into a lot of schools for tuba. I think in our country, unlike England, we don't understand the difference between a doctorate of music, which is a DM, or a doctor of musical arts, a DMA. Mm. I'm the first African-American to get a doctorate of music, a DM, and only a select few institutions offered. I think right now, Florida and Indiana University, and the difference is in the curriculum. And people say, oh, isn't it the same thing? No, sir. How about you go look up the curriculum and figure out why I started a degree in 2000 and didn't finish until 2012?
That's a long time. Yeah, that's some dedication.
I mean, I left. I was working, but it is an intense degree. Everyone will tell you it's one of the hardest doctors to get. I'm grateful that I was there because it was part of my history. And I think that to get in the studio like IU, yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. He has an extraordinary wait list. I think he feeds probably, I would say, a good 30-40% of other schools based on the students that he can't take, and they're top-notch students.
So it's pretty amazing the trajectory that your life has taken to get into all of these very hard-to-get-into programs.
Well, Indiana, another thing I should say, Indiana is tuba royalty. I mean, William Bell was the first teacher. Second teacher was Mr. Harvey Phillips, the Paganini of tuba. And I mean, he created Oktoberfest, which is happening now. So today, I think, is October the 6th in Mr. Phillips' world. He created Tuba Christmas, Tuba Valentine's Day. If we could put tuba on it, we'd do it. And Tuba Christmas was, you know, created many years ago. He called out Rockefeller and said, hey, I want to have Tuba Christmas here. They're like, who are you? I'm Mr. Phillips. He told them to check his references, and then they gave him Oktoberfest.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. Once again, we have Richard beatboxing on his tuba in a collaborative track with his brother William. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
Don't throw up, I get it back. Then I never lose it, then I'm cruising. If you understand me, then you get it back. Because you know I'm moving. I'm only trying to make one day.
This is All In. I'm Miriam Soh. Back now to our conversation with Richard Antoine White, principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic and Santa Fe Symphony, and a professor of tuba and euphonium at the University of New Mexico. If you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Richard, you teach at the University of New Mexico. How did you end up going down that path?
How about I share the funny story? I came to New Mexico to be in the New Mexico Symphony, which folded, and I'm a founding member of the New Mexico Philharmonic, which is building roots now and growing. I was adjunct at the University of New Mexico. Once the symphony folded, I was about to hit the road and take auditions again. I was like, man, I don't really want to do this, but I guess I have to. So I had a meeting with the music school, and I said, hey, can we get me a job? And they were like, we don't have the money. And I said, so you're saying if I find the money, I can have a job, a tenure track job? So me, with that street mind, I went home and said, who got the money? I went, oh, athletics. I called athletics, set up a meeting with them, and said, hey, can I teach your athletes respiratory function? Because as a tuba player, I know how to breathe. And it was a 5-minute meeting. They said, absolutely, sure. And that's how I got a tenure track job at the University of New Mexico.
That is awesome. Okay, I need to learn some tips here. So you're teaching at the University of New Mexico. And then I read from your story that you were auditioning for, I think it was the symphony. And it was like a blind audition, and they had a curtain up and everything. And you didn't make the first round.
Oh, this was so... What's crazy? That's a great question. I took the New Mexico Symphony Orchestra audition 3 times. The first 2 times, it was a no-go. And the third time, I won. There's several auditions, I think, during the 2000s. A lot of people retired, and there was a lot of shifting in orchestras in America. First time I went, I played maybe 3 excerpts. That means 3 songs. And they were like, thank you. I'm like, man, I came all the way to this place, first of all, to a place, a state that I never even heard of, New Mexico, and I only got to play for 1.5 minutes. It's crazy. Yeah. So the second time, I was like, I'm going back. I was determined, but I played slightly better. And the third time, it just worked out. I'm a fan of blind auditions. I think if we take the screen down, it's going to lead to more stereotyping and labeling. I think it's really about the music. You don't listen with your eyes. You listen with your ears. I know there is improvement to be made in systems that could be better, but I don't have those answers right now.
So these blind auditions predate The Voice then. It sounds like The Voice has some copyright issues here.
Oh, yeah, I think, right. The Voice copied the modern day orchestra. That's correct. That's an awesome observation.
I'm thinking, because I thought it was fascinating how... for these auditions, like the floor is made quiet with a carpet, so you can't even hear if it's a woman in heels or somebody wearing different shoes, and the auditioner doesn't even speak. Has it always been like that?
Oh, yeah. Like in America, it's been like that. I think in Europe and other countries, the systems are different. But, you know, and the odds, I mean, LA Philharmonic has a tuba opening right now. I'm pretty sure they're going to get like 300 applicants. Maybe they'll invite 150, 200 people. Only one tuba is going to win that job. Wow. That's the odds when I talk about NBA. And yeah, you don't want to hear shoes. You can't cough. You can't speak, because if someone behind the committee recognized your cough or recognized that you're the only female auditioning that day, that gives you an unfair advantage.
Is part of the huge number of folks auditioning due to the fact that there's limited spots, is part of the limited spots because people are in these positions for a lifetime, and until they retire or decide to leave, there's just no opportunity?
It's a combination of all the above. I don't know why music get picked on so much, but I don't think it's any different than athletes. You know, the number of tubists, of people wanting to be tubists, has grown. It's extraordinary, much like athletes. How many of athletes actually make a living leaving school, but yet we don't complain as much about them as we do about music? You know, you're talking about being part of the 1%. It's, you're trying to do something that's extraordinary. So everyone's chasing that dream, probably just like NBA tryouts or something. You have hundreds of players and probably three of them are going to make it. If that, same odds, same scenarios in my mind.
We touched upon briefly earlier in the conversation just about diversity and equity in classical music. Have you seen a shift in your time in this industry?
Oh, it's the hot topic. There's a lot of windows being opened. That's why I said I don't believe in well-intended tokenism. Everything you earn has to be earned. I do think that the representation over the years has not been equal, but I also think that there's some natural occurrences. Like if you were to just take tuba, for example, and say, how come there's only like a few African-American tubas in orchestra? I would ask you, well, let's take the last 100 years. Well, we couldn't even take 100 because let's take the last 50 years. That's more like it. And see how many African-American tubists audition versus Caucasian. It would probably be something like 1,000 to 30. Mm-hmm. And you tell me how the odds are going to lay. There's not necessarily an injustice there. There's a lack of exposure there.
Well, with the lack of exposure, would you say that part of that is an injustice where, you know, only certain groups of people are exposed to different types of opportunities because of the systemic racism and the way the structure has been laid in place?
Yeah, I would say that on both sides, not just white institutions, but historically Black colleges too. And it's tradition in addition to. And this is why things have been so stifled. Everyone wants to hold on tradition and they feel like their tradition is threatened. I'm saying preserve your tradition. We recognize it. It's worth playing your music, but let's add the words or the term in addition to. Tradition in addition to is how we move forward, in my opinion.
And how does one make a classical music something that, not just for folks that want to go into it, but people that want to listen to it? And I'm thinking of, you know, this summer I attended like a classical music out in a park, and I looked around and I noticed it was generally the audience was older white folks, and they're just probably retired, or, you know, I'm making assumptions here, but they're sitting there and enjoying their life. And I'm thinking, not a lot of people have the time to just carve out 2 hours of their afternoon.
I think we have to have a cultural shift, and we have to have exposure, and we need to recognize that the same notes that make rap music, country music, classical music, they're all chosen from the same set of notes. And how you choose to present them is up to the people performing. So I think we need an integration. We have to stop being so segregated. Sure, you can have rap music and classical music together. Sure, you can have classical music and country together. We've historically have had segments of music so segregated, much like education. Like, I don't know the professors in the English department. Hey, why don't a poet come and play with us in the symphony? I think we need this interdisciplinary idea in education, and I also think we need this collaborative idea in classical music to save it. We have to be current with current affairs, and the music has to be relative. So instead of being so segregated with, oh, we only play music from the 1800s, how about we play music from the 1800s and today?
Yeah, I think that would be amazing just to hear classical orchestras playing things that some of us can relate to, because that's the music we've grown up with.
Right. And so the idea is that, oh, we don't want to offend anyone, you know, but I'm sticking to my statement, tradition in addition to.
I'm going to write that down. That's a great quote tradition in addition to. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Richard Antoine White, principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic and Santa Fe Symphony, and a professor of tuba and euphonium at the University of New Mexico, about his new memoir as well as his journey in this entire industry. I do want to get back to the book a little bit here. You mentioned that your mother told you you're going to be somebody, I know it, and that things will be hard, but you will be someone, you're my star. Does that feel like she knew this was going to happen for you?
Yeah, it feels like she gave me the same thing that I praised my imagination. I feel like she had it. I was her kid. She loved me. She loved me enough to believe that I was going to be something. I was going to do extraordinary things. And I think that's a gift she gave me. And as you read that, I can hear her saying it, and I believe it.
And that shows, I think, also the importance of having someone that believes in you and gives you that inspiration to keep going.
Yeah, just because someone doesn't fit the mold of societal decorum, it doesn't mean that that it has to be that way. There are a thousand ways to get to the top of the mountain. And I think my mom blessed me with a resource of hope. That's a resource. She told me I was going to be somebody. That gave me an imagination to be someone in hope. And that was a big part of the resources that I needed to be as resilient as I am.
As the first African-American to earn a doctorate degree in tuba performance, were you expecting that you would be the first? Was it a shock to you?
No, I didn't want to get a doctorate, but I was on the subway in Baltimore feeling a little awkward, actually, because, you know, I was institutionalized. I wasn't that used to seeing African-Americans again. And I was talking to my dad on the phone, and I said, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to finish this degree, man. Dad, I got a job. And this little kid overheard me talking, and he tugged on my shirt and said, hey, mister, you going to be a doctor? And I went, dang, man. At that moment, I knew I had to I had to finish the degree to show this little kid that he could do it too. And that really propelled me to finish it.
And what does it mean, this milestone? What does it mean for you, for the community as a whole, to have you sort of paving this new path?
It means that it's possible, just like my book, Against All Odds. It means that rather than talk about it, I have showed you that it's possible. And that will live in history. So now this little kid will go, I'm going to play in the symphony. I know it's possible because Richard White did it. That's what it means. Against all odds, the word impossible becomes I am possible. And that's what that degree, being the first at something, means. I don't want to be the first at something so you can praise me or whatever. I think it should be recognized because I didn't have a mentor saying, look out for this or don't do this. It was all me. You know, when I failed, I had to figure it out the hard way. And I'm trying to create a path that allows as many people as possible to elevate and excel to the best of their abilities.
What would you say is your biggest accomplishment so far?
Being a teacher, that every day I get to go to work and make a difference in the kids' life, because that's what so many did for me.
Did you expect you'd become a teacher, or did you think you were just going to be performing for the rest of your life?
No, it's in my blood. I wanted to be an orchestral symphony player. I didn't want to teach. You know, but Darren Perrantoni told me, Mr. Phillips told me this, Richard, and I'm going to tell you this. I've watched you teach and work with my students. It's meant for you to be a teacher. And he couldn't have been more right. It's not just about the tuba notes. I'm teaching people to be good citizens. I'm teaching people to contribute to our society and at the same time play music.
Did you learn anything new about yourself when you were writing this, or discover something that you'd forgotten about?
Oh, a whole lot. I mean, I think for all of our self-identification, I think we're all afraid to go to the basement, because in the basement, that's where the boogeyman lives, right? Or we don't want to dig up those roots. I learned that I need to dig up some roots. I learned that I need to go to the basement, the bottom floor, dig up some roots and find out what I'm made of, because I have not been to the bottom floor enough. Not in terms of have and have not, but in terms of really identifying certain things that is the makeup of me. So I intend to go to the basement, dig up some roots, and find out what has been nourishing, what kind of nourishment has been feeding my soul and my being.
Did you learn anything different that, for example, maybe as a child you viewed it in a certain way, but now as an adult you see it differently?
Yes. I learned that my mom really loved me. And that as a child, I was angry because she gave me up. But I learned now that she was a hero. like she gave me a chance. And I'm so grateful for it.
And how has the reception been since you've released the book? Anybody close to you have anything to say about it?
It's been mixed. You know, all the world probably are really excited for me. Obviously, it's embarrassing. If we all start writing about our family, some family members would get really mad. Some families, there's a little bit of controversy saying, that didn't happen, this didn't happen. You know, it's all been researched. It's all been documented. And it's interesting because people complaining that I don't actually know. I'm like, okay, and you're... So people that are close to me in that sense are seeing the story and I guess maybe feel a little shame, but people that are in my everyday life are proud. They're getting reinvigorated. They're getting proud. The country that doesn't know me and the listeners that I'm meeting for the first time saying, man, you gave me hope. You gave me life. And that's my goal. So I think it's been extraordinarily positive. I think every time I get an opportunity to speak like today, I take advantage of it because I believe my story is relatable. I believe that there are thousands of Richard Whites in every city and we should try to find them.
If you could go back and tell yourself, your younger self, anything, what do you think you would tell yourself?
Oh, wow. That's a really awesome question. If I could go back and tell myself anything, I would remind myself, I would whisper in my ear, hey, remember, you're a superhero. You can do anything because being a superhero means that you get to eliminate limitations.
Do you think that having such a positive attitude is what's helped you overcome a lot of obstacles? Because I'm thinking there's many people who have been through things and some people are resilient and they come out happy and some people come out angry. What was it that compelled you to just keep such a positive attitude?
I keep it simple. I look at the alternative. No one wakes up today, yawn, oh, what a beautiful day. I think I'm going to have a crappy day. That's not normal. You know, so I think positivity is the animal, is the beast that I want to feed. So I keep feeding it. I think it's better than the alternative. Negativity, doesn't taste good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about this myself because I'm one of those. I'm trying to be more positive because I can always find something wrong. Maybe it's a journalism thing where like you're always trying to find the flaws in things. But
right, it's something I would say. Think of it as in terms of energy. We only have a limited amount of time on this earth, so we can count the days, we can count the years, and live up. So think about every day you get so much energy to use. How do you want to use your energy? Well, I want to use it in a way that's going to feed the most things in the right direction. So if I'm positive, that's going to propel me to do other things because it's positive energy. Negative energy is going to slow me down. It's going to take away from other things because I'm going to dwell. I'm going to be sad. I only have but so much energy in the day. So I'm going with the positivity.
Yes. And positive energy is definitely a lot more nourishing because I can tell you the negative energy, you just feel like you don't want to do anything.
Yes, it's paralyzing. You can get paralysis if you focus too much on the negative. And if you focus on the positive, you can get recharged.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to say to our listeners if they are thinking about pursuing something and feeling like the world is against them?
Yes, I would like to say it takes a village. Please offer the world the best version of yourself. I promise to offer the world the best version of me. And I think if we work together, us putting our best together has to equal something magnificent and magical. So offer the world your best. And most of all, be kind to one another.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Richard Antoine White is the principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic and Santa Fe Symphony and a professor of tuba and euphonium at the University of New Mexico. His new memoir is called I'm Possible, a story of survival, a tuba, and the small miracle of a big dream. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.